Hey, good morning, everybody. We are going to get started. So I'm going to turn some of these lights down, and that's probably about as good as I can do. Is everybody okay? You can see your notes, that kind of thing. All right, so let's take a look at the schedule first. So we just got done with Labor Day weekend. Today is September 9th, and we're going to talk about integumentary system, or your integument. And that's a pretty important organ because it is, what, the largest one in your body. Yeah, that's kind of noteworthy. All right, so today is a Wednesday. When is your first test? So Monday, no test. We got a lecture, but 1 week from today, September 16th, is your first exam. So what do you use? What's your primary resource for preparing for a lecture exam? Study guides, that's right. I hope you found them, printed them out, or loaded them to your hard drive or something like that and have worked with them, right? That's really important. You cannot study Tuesday evening for this test that you have on Wednesday, right? You'll need some sleep cycles so that you remember some of this stuff. And repetition is one way to learn it. Drawing some of the stuff out on a blank piece of paper will help as well, right? And we've done some of that in lab. The exam chapters are 1, 2, 4, 5, and 6. We're skipping 3, and all those study guides should be available to you to use. Okay, so what will you need for a lecture exam? You'll need a Scantron, but I turned the light off so you can't see what it looks like, but I'm going to turn the lights back on. Go ahead, hold the Scantron up. That's it. And it should say something like 882E or 882ES. Either of those work. There's an 882EZ or something like that. That does not work very well. Get the ones that have where you pencil in your answer. Those are blank without any kind of color in the background. Some Scantrons are already colored in the background and the reader has a hard time grading those. But anyway, all of you, I pass them back in lab. We go over the tests in lab. So you'll be able to review your test and make sure it was graded properly and all that kind of stuff. Anybody got a question about the Scantron? No? Good. Then you need a picture ID as well when you turn your test in. Not beforehand, but when you turn your test in, show me a picture ID. And I'll try to get down here as soon as I can after lab. So maybe like today, I opened up a little bit early. And then when you come in the room, just be prepared to take the test because I'm going to hand you a test. If you need to study a little while longer, just have a seat out in the hallway, okay, until you're ready to take the test. But the test is going to be over at the usual time that this class is over because there's another class after us that comes in. So we can't really extend that time. Plus, I got lab, too, afterwards. All right, so a good pencil and also something even a better eraser. Your eraser has to be excellent. Make a pencil mark on a piece of paper, erase it with your eraser, and you should not see anything of a mark left over. If it's a smudge, then throw that eraser away because it's going to make a smudge on your Scantron. The reader won't be able to grade it. And maybe I will be able to tell, maybe not, that you erased it. I'm not sure. Sometimes it's really hard to tell. So get a good eraser. Your syllabus gives you a couple names of good erasers. And that's crucial because you guys are going to be taking board exams sometime, and board exams are on a Scantron. And so you just got to be really good with marking a Scantron because if you mark something on a board exam and you know the answer but it got smudged or somehow a stray mark got on the Scantron, you'll get that question wrong and it might be the one that prevents you from passing the board exam, right? Which is terrible. But another really terrible thing is board exams are not free. So if you have to recycle through a board exam, then you have to pay all over again. So might as well just make that Scantron as perfect as possible for any machine to read. All right, so that's pretty good for the exam. Anybody got a question about the exam? When is it going to be? Yeah, and it's 1 week. That's what I was thinking. But you're right, September 16th, 1 week. That's going to be on a Wednesday. The next one's going to be on a Monday, but the one coming up is going to be on a Wednesday. And okay, so people that have lab still have lab that day, okay, and a lecture exam. All right, we were looking at tissues last time. Anybody have any questions on tissues? I think I got through the whole chapter. All right, how many major kinds of tissues are there in your body? Yeah, there's four. And you should be able to tell me what they are. Any order is fine with me, but you might as well tell me in the order that we studied them. It is epithelium, connective tissue, muscle tissue, and nervous tissue. And you should probably have some kind of idea of generally where these things are or what they do. So where is an epithelium located? What is its job? Covers a surface of something or lines a cavity. That's what an epithelium is for. So the lining on the inside of a blood vessel is an epithelium. The lining of your digestive tract is an epithelium. The lining of your body is an epithelium. But we call it an epidermis, but it's an epithelium, and you'll be able to classify it by its rules. Okay, and I guess I don't want to spend too much time, but if somebody has a question, how we classify? Two main ways are by shape of cells and number of layers. Okay, and also epithelium makes glands. We talked about two major kinds of glands in your body. One that has a duct and another gland that does not have a duct. Which one has a duct? Exocrine, right? So an exocrine gland makes a product, secretes it into a duct, and then the duct carries it to where it's going to have its proper action. And an endocrine gland, does it have a duct? No. What does it have instead to carry its product around in the body? It secretes something. Yeah, it secretes, and then a capillary picks it up into the blood, and the blood delivers it all over the body, so it doesn't need a duct. All right, so an endocrine gland is a ductless gland. All right, connective tissues, we looked at all these things. What do you call a cell that makes fibers? A cell in a connective tissue that makes fibers. Yeah, a fibroblast. How many types of fibers do you know? Three kinds, and in order of strength, you should know their names. All right, what kind of cell do you find in bone? Osteocyte. Yeah, osteo's bone. What type of cell do you see in cartilage? Chondro. Nice. What kind of cell do you see in blood? Erythrocyte, right? Or you could say red blood cell. There's also white blood cells in there. I think there was another kind. Oh, what kind of cell do you see in adipose tissue? What kind of cell do you see in adipose tissue? Another name for adipose is fat, but I like the term adipose. So the cell that you find in adipose CT is an adipocyte. Adipocyte. Okay, cyte is cell, adipose is the kind of tissue. All right, so that's all the connective tissues. Muscle tissue. What is muscle specialized to do? Yeah, you could say movement, and you're right, but I want to go down to a more basic level, and it is what? Contraction. And when a muscle contracts, that produces motion. What kind of muscle is attached to your skeleton? What kind of muscle is attached to your skeleton? I don't know. Nobody want to volunteer a good answer for that? Yes, you're right. It is skeletal muscle. Skeletal muscle is attached to your skeleton, and you can control where your skeleton goes. Like if you want to get up and leave this class right now, you can, or if you want to come down to the front row. Like some people in that back row should come down to the front row. Skeletal muscle would allow you to do that. I'm kidding. You guys don't have to come on down. You can stay there. Okay. And what kind of muscles in your heart? Cardiac muscle, and in the walls of hollow organs like uterus, fallopian tube, urethra, ureter, any part of your digestive tract is smooth muscle, right? Smooth muscle. Okay. And then we looked at nervous tissue. Two main kinds of cells in nervous tissue were neurons and neuroglial cells. And neurons are the ones that send electrical nerve impulses fast over long distances. Okay. I see a couple terms right here. Peri. What does peri mean? Peri. Okay, it surrounds something. Like a periosteum. You know what osteo means? Periosteum is something that surrounds a bone. And it's a membrane, a special kind of membrane. And we're going to look at that. We haven't yet. All right, so I'm ready to move on to the integumentary system unless somebody has a question about histology. And in lab, we go over exactly what you need to know for the practicum. But what is the answer key for the practicum? that you have in your possession? The lab manual is the answer key. So that's what you should spend time on. And for pictures underneath a microscope, we call that a micrograph, you can use the pictures in your textbook, right? Because I know all of you don't have a microscope at home. Some of you do, but not all of you. So study with pictures in your textbook. For slides of mitosis or any of the connective tissues, any of the tissues, right, for the practicum. All right, so I think we're all in pretty good lockstep. We know what's going on. No questions on the schedule. Fantastic. All right. Ah, nice. All right, so I'm going to put this maybe somewhere over here, like that. Maybe like that. Oh, yeah, like that. That works. Okay, integumentary system. All right, it's composed of skin, and we're starting to talk about skin in lab, but it also is composed of accessory structures. So something that isn't really skin, a layer of the skin, but it protects the skin or gives skin some special properties to protect it. Right? And some of these accessory structures are hair, nails, glands, and muscle. And you're probably familiar with one kind of gland. Does anybody know what kind of gland you have in the integumentary system? Yes, sweat glands. That's really good. And there's a couple other kinds of glands, too, that I heard. And indeed, there's actually three kinds of glands. But sweat glands, everybody's familiar with because we're probably all sweating right now. A lot of buildings on campus don't even have any air conditioning. It went out somehow. Isn't that funny how it always, air conditioning goes out on the hottest day of the year? I don't know how that happens. But that should be a bet in Las Vegas. Oh, except everybody would lose the bet and everybody would win millions of dollars. Okay, so you got skin and accessory structures. All right, and so then what is the function? We got a couple functions. Some of these you're familiar with, maybe some you are not. All right, the first one is protection. Your book maybe breaks this down into two categories. I have it as one. It protects internal structures from infection. That's one, but it also protects internal structures from dehydration. So there's actually two components for this protection. And without skin, we would dehydrate in, this is a wild guess, but pretty good guess, probably about 2 minutes. We'd turn into a potato chip. So that's how important the skin is. And also, we'd be very susceptible to infection. And that would take a little bit longer to have an effect on somebody, but it would be just as deadly. And so when somebody loses their skin, what are the first two things that somebody has to be concerned about? What should we do to protect their body? Okay, dehydration, right, and infection are two of the most important concerns that people, so you give them fluids and try to get their skin back. If it can't grow back, then a graft has to be placed or even a temporary graft. All right, another thing, and you talked about this already, function is regulation of body temperature. What happens to your skin when you get really, really cold? Yeah, you get goosebumps. There's a muscle that contracts in there, right, that generates a little heat. And what does your skin look like besides goosebumps? Okay, maybe nobody got really, really cold. That's great. It also turns a little blue, okay, when you're really, really cold. And the reason why is because blood doesn't get up into your skin because it would get cold and cool your body down even more. Blood is prevented from getting up into the skin so that you retain heat deep inside your body, which is the most important place because that's where your heart is, that's where your lungs are. Okay, it's okay if your fingers get cold. And another thing, vitamin D production. And you need sunlight for your skin to take a precursor of vitamin D and turn it into a compound that's a little bit better of a vitamin D. Does anybody know what vitamin D is for? Why do we have vitamin D in our body? Maybe a lot of reasons, but one that we've learned a long time ago is that vitamin D is necessary to absorb calcium from your intestinal tract or in your diet. All right, so if you have plenty of calcium in your diet but no vitamin D, what happens to your bones, for instance? They start to demineralize because bones are made mostly out of calcium. All right, so vitamin D is important. And then sensation is also communication with your environment. What kind of sensations have you felt today? hot. Oh yeah, everybody. So we got thermoreceptors, temperature receptors in your skin. Okay. You have pressure receptors. When you put your clothes on, you felt your clothes sliding over your body. Maybe somebody poked you in the side today, right? And to get your attention. What did I do in lab to get people's attention? Oh, we stimulated their photoreceptors. Ah, but that's not part of the integumentary system because we had a wasp fly through lab. Okay. But fortunately, the wasp didn't sting anybody. Now, if the wasp did sting somebody, then your integumentary system would have told you, right? Because you'd have that poison, and you'd have then pain receptors telling you that something bad happened. All right, so those are some functions of skin. And so here's the skin. How many main layers I see? I see two main layers. Epidermis, which is on top of the dermis. Those are the two main layers. Maybe a little bit confusing on this slide because I also have hypodermis. And what does hypo mean? Let's talk about that first. Below the dermis, right? Got epidermis on top, hypodermis below. The hypodermis is a connective tissue that is not part of the skin, but it's closely related to the skin, so we talk about it in this class now, even though it's not really part of the skin. All right, so two main layers, epidermis and dermis, and epidermis is a superficial layer. It's an epithelium, so you should be able to characterize it by shape and layers, and it just so happens that it's a squamous, stratified squamous epithelium. Let's take a look at the illustration on the right-hand side. All right, so the epidermis goes from where I have the pointer right now to right here. This is all epidermis, and you can see that is not just homogeneous, but there are some shadings of color as you move from the basement part of this epithelium to the apical surface. So there are some layers in the epithelium. Not a really good slide to talk about the layers, but we're going to talk about them a little bit later. Okay, and this epithelium, right, grows from one of these layers. Maybe that would be good to discuss right now. Where is this epithelium growing from? It's growing from the deepest layer, and that deepest layer we call stratum basale. So when something is growing, what's the process that's happening with those cells? Mitosis, that's right. So this is the layer that's undergoing mitosis. So when one cell divides into two, one of those cells gets pushed up toward the surface, and then it gets pushed up further and further and further when these cells undergo further mitosis in the stratum basale. All right, okay, that's pretty good for now. So then we have the dermis. The dermis is from where I have the cursor right now all the way down to here. And I notice some blood vessels. Here's an artery, here is a vein in the dermis. Do you see any blood vessels in the epidermis? No. All right, so the epidermis never has blood vessels. It might have some nerve fibers like pain receptors and things like that, but no blood vessels. So that's one of the jobs of the dermis, is to bring nutrients and oxygen to the epidermis and to remove waste products like CO2 and other kinds of things. All right, and these little waves right here, this is what we call a dermal papillae. And these capillaries from these arteries and veins poke up into this dermal papillae. Look at this. I can see it right here. This is called a subpapillary vascular plexus. This is a special capillary that does a really good job of providing nourishment to the stratum basale. And so that's why we have dermal papillae, because it's loaded with capillaries nourishing the epidermis, because epidermis doesn't have blood vessels all by itself. All right, layers of the dermis. Right, this layer right here that has that subpapillary vascular plexus, or sometimes we call it dermal plexus, this is the papillary layer named after these projections up into the epidermis. Then there's a deeper layer, and I can see on this illustration something really noteworthy about this layer. This is called reticular layer. This is the strongest layer of the skin, even compared to the epidermis, because it has all of these fibers. Tell me what kind of fibers these are. Collagen. Yeah, collagen is the strongest fiber, and your dermis is loaded with collagen fibers, so that is the strongest part of your skin as a result. And so this is a dense, irregular connective tissue. kind of like joint capsules, and they're very, very strong. Almost as strong as a tendon or a ligament as a result. All right, so those are some of the layers, and maybe I'll talk about layers of the epidermis right now, since we're talking about layers. And here is a pretty good, here is a micrograph or a picture looking through a microscope, and this is all I see is epidermis, but I see a little dermis down over here. Here's the tip of a dermal papillae, and here is the basal layer. That's the stratum basale, and if we look close, we might be able to see a cell undergoing mitosis. I'm not sure I do, but this one almost looks like a cell undergoing mitosis. I see a dark line here, not here, but then over here. That almost looks to me like, anybody take a guess what phase this looks like? Where chromosomes are starting to separate? Yeah, anaphase. That kind of looks like anaphase to me. I don't have a really good look at the cell, but that's probably it. All right, so stratum basale, and then the layer right above it, because cells are getting pushed up. These cells have these really sharp points to them. You see this sharp point over here? Kind of a sharp point right over here and here, but there's also some sharp point pointing at you that you can't see because it's out of the plane of this image. So this is the stratum spinosum, because these little things sometimes are called spines. On bones, they're called spines. Stratum spinosum. And then these cells get pushed up a little bit further, and I see a bunch of granules inside these cells, stratum granulosum. And now they get pushed up even further to the surface, and now they're really far away from these blood vessels that are in the dermis. They can't get enough oxygen, can't get enough nutrients, and they die as a result of that. So this layer here is filled with cells that are dead, right? But they protect our skin because they're filled with a chemical called keratin. Keratin. Keratin is kind of a hard chemical, but it's inside the cell. It's not extracellular like collagen is. Keratin is inside. All right, so what's the function? All these granules that we see right here are filled with pre-keratin, something that will be metabolized into keratin, and also there's some lipids that are produced that are going to be secreted. And what can you tell me about a lipid or oil and water? Oil and water, do they mix?
No.
They don't, right? So as these cells produce a little oil and is secreted between the cells, that prevents dehydration because water can no longer get through, right? As long as there's no laceration through the skin. And then the job of the stratum corneum is that it's tough, right? And it's kind of pliable, so it moves with your body, but it protects underlying structures like the stratum basale. Nice. So this is a kind of skin that typically we call thin skin. Right? It has these four layers to it. Let's look at an illustration because I see some important cells that I can't see on that micrograph. All right, so here is the stratum basale, and usually it's one layer cells. I don't see a cell undergoing metaphase right there. I can't quite tell. Stratum basale, and then these spiky cells. You can see the cells are starting to shrink, but they're connected to neighboring cells by these. Desmosomes is a cell-to-cell connection. So this is the stratum spinosum. Then they get pushed up farther, and I can just barely see some granules in the stratum granulosum. And then here is the stratum corneum, cells filled with keratin. Okay, because these cells are filled with keratin, sometimes these skin cells are called keratinocytes. What does site mean? That means cell, yeah. And keratin is the name of the chemical that makes this outer layer of your skin pretty solid and strong. Right? Not so strong that you can't move, but it gives some strength to the skin. And where do we find this keratin? I want to make a really nice point. I made it earlier. Where do you find keratin? Okay, so what kind of tissue are we looking at once again? It's an epidermis, right? And an epidermis is an epithelium. And what can you tell me about spaces between cells in an epithelium? Yeah, these cells are close together, they're joined together, so there's no space between them. So this keratin really doesn't have any place to go, it stays inside the cell. It's a strong chemical that is intracellular. It stays inside the cell. as opposed to another strong kind of chemical that you know, and that is collagen. Collagen you don't find in an epithelium. Where do you find collagen? In what kind of tissue? In a connective tissue, right? And remember, there are huge spaces between cells in a connective tissue. What generally do we call that space? Because it's so special. It's called the matrix. Yeah, it's called the matrix. And so the fibers in a connective tissue are secreted into the matrix, and the strongest fiber is called, you told me already, collagen. So collagen is extracellular. It's found outside the cell. Keratin, on the other hand, is intracellular. It's trapped inside the cell. Okay, but sort of the same function, except collagen is even stronger. So those are the layers of something we call thin skin. I see a couple interesting cells. Here I see a cell, and it's got all of these little arms coming off of it. We call those processes. Even a bone, if it has something coming off like that, we call that a process. That's a structure. A process is a structure. So it has all these processes going between cells, right, in the stratum spinosum. We call it a dendritic cell because that reminded somebody of a neuron, and these things we call dendrites in a neuron. And so it's called a dendritic cell. It's got another name. It's called a Langerhans cell. And I think in the back of the chapter you have a question that asks you what's the name of this cell right here. The answer is Langerhans. So I know that a dendritic cell is a Langerhans cell. And furthermore, you're probably wondering, what's the function of this thing? Well, this is protects your skin from infection. So it's an immune cell. It fights infection. That's what its job is. And all of these processes right here can identify bacteria, fungi, maybe other things that don't belong in your body, and then it helps come up with a strategy to kill those things so that you don't have that infection. Dendritic cell, part of your immune system. You'll also have a tactile cell right here. When this cell bends, it sends electrical information to this neuron, and then that neuron takes that information to the brain, and you know something is touching the skin. And this is a really small one. And it can respond to very light pressure and vibration. It doesn't have to be a very strong pressure for this one to pick it up. And as a matter of fact, there are people that can probably read with these kind of cells. How would somebody that's blind read with, this is a Merkel's disc right here. How would they read with this tactile cell? Tactile means touching. How would they read? Yeah, Braille, right? Because they will run their finger over a piece of paper and it has dimples on it, and they can feel the pattern of the dimples, and then they know what the letter is or what the word is. So that's interesting. In traditional, we call it Chinese medicine, but maybe we would rather call it traditional Asian medicine. There are doctors that are blind. So how would a doctor that is blind help you? Okay, they're taught how to feel what's happening inside your body with their fingers by palpation. So they would use these things to come up with a diagnosis to help their patients. Right? That would be a really sophisticated doctor. Most doctors can't do that kind of stuff. All right, here is another kind of cell. It is a melanocyte. All right, and in the name of the cell, remember, cell means site, so what's the name of the compound that it produces? It is melanin. Okay. And melanin is a pigment. Okay, so what the heck is a pigment? Your book just says it's a pigment. A pigment is a chemical compound that can absorb a certain color of light. And instead of color, we can say a certain frequency of light, right? A certain part of the spectrum of light. And part of the spectrum of light that it can absorb is even one that we can't see, and it is ultraviolet light. Ultraviolet light is very damaging to your body. So this cell right here protects you from ultraviolet light, which comes from the sun. So melanocyte protects you from sunlight. The darker your skin is, means it has more melanocytes, and more melanin is the name of the chemical, the more protected you are from the harmful effects of the sun when you go outside. Right? So melanin is a natural sunscreen produced by a melanocyte. And what layer of the skin are melanocytes found? Stratum basale, that's right. And this melanocyte right here actually comes from nervous system tissue. right? And I don't see any nerves around here, so this cell actually has moved away from a nerve and crawled into the skin, so its basic nature is to move around in your body. And that makes it kind of a very dangerous kind of cell, right? Because sometimes the cell turns cancerous, right? And it produces a melanoma, is what it's called. And why is that so dangerous? The nature of this cell is to want to move around from one spot of your body to another. And so if this thing forms a tumor and it moves to another part of your body, then we call that cancer. So melanomas are pretty dangerous, right? Aggressive kinds of cancer, because that's what this cell likes to do, right? It likes to migrate around in your body. But it produces a pigment to absorb harmful things that are produced in the sun. What color are the seats that you're sitting on right now? Yellow. Yeah, they're yellow. And they have that color yellow because they have a, what's a general name for what they have that allows it, you to see some kind of color? It has pigments, right? The plastic has pigments in there. And when you shine a light on it, and remember light, if you break light apart into all of its components, you see a rainbow, right? So sunlight has all the colors of a rainbow. And when sunlight hits that chair, it looks yellow because yellow is the color of the light that it cannot absorb. But it absorbs the blue and the green and the red, right? That color goes away, and what gets reflected back to your eye is the yellow part of the rainbow. So that's why things have a particular color. So something that looks blue, it has a pigment that absorbs all colors except blue, right? That gets reflected back to your eye that you can see. Okay. The color of melanin is variable, but it's very dark. Could be black, could be brown, dark brown, light brown. So when it's black and dark brown, it means that it absorbs all the colors, right? So that's its job to do that, including ultraviolet light. All right, so that is a really nice example of thin skin. Here is an example of skin, and I see a lot of the dermis here as well. So here is the line that separates what? What is this line separating? The epidermis from the dermis, right? So everything we see up over here is epidermis, everything below is dermis, and we can get the dermis out of the way really quick. The layer of the dermis that pokes up into these dermal papillae is called the papillary layer, and then the layer down over here that's loaded with this really strong fiber, this is the reticular layer, and you know the name of this fiber, right? That's collagen. All right, so that's it for the dermis. What about the epidermis? The first layer you're very familiar with. That is the stratum basale. You might be able to see some cells that have a dark pigment, maybe brown in here. Lab, we had some really beautiful slides that showed those melanocytes really nicely. So we got stratum basale. This is the growing layer. It pushes cells up into the next layer where they start to shrink, right, and form little processes or spikes or spines all over them. So that's the spinosum. And then this kind of skin has one layer, right, of cells that have a lot of granules in them, so that's a stratum granulosum. And then you see something that looks like a white line right through here. That's an important layer. And this is the kind of layer that we see only in thick skin, not thin skin. This is called stratum lucidum. Stratum lucidum is this thin layer. We find it only in thick skin. And then the other difference between thick and thin is that the stratum corneum is a lot deeper, or a lot thicker is probably a better way to talk about that. And so since it's thicker, then we call that thick skin, stratum corneum. What kind of chemicals in the stratum corneum that makes the stratum corneum really strong? Keratin, yeah. And so all of these are keratinocytes, or remnants of keratinocytes, right, after they have died. All right, how can you remember stratum lucidum? Does anybody know the definition of lucid? What does lucid mean? Really clear. Yeah, when you're speaking, when you talk to somebody and you're lucid, that means you're speaking clearly and they can understand what they're talking about. So stratum lucidum. Okay. Now, I haven't pointed out hypodermis anywhere, so I'm going to go back a couple slides. Oh, no, I'm zooming. Don't want to zoom. Okay. So let me go back right here. I probably don't need that anymore. Let's look at this slide. All right, so we looked at the layers of the epidermis, The layers of the dermis aren't too complicated, so we can even see them on this slide. The dermis goes from the bottom of this dermal papillae all the way down to where we run into these adipocytes. The adipocytes are not found in the dermis. They're found in the layer below the dermis, which is the hypodermis, right? So if you get an injection with a hypodermic needle, where does that material end up when you get that shot? In the hypodermis, right? Because it's a hypodermic needle. It's below the dermis that medication is inserted into. And so the hypodermis is a loose connective tissue, and in a lot of cases it's adipose connective tissue. And we store a lot of fat, right, in our bodies in this layer in the hypodermis. Sometimes it's called a subcutaneous layer, because sometimes the skin is called the cutaneous membrane, subcutaneous layer, or hypodermis. And it also sometimes is called superficial fascia. Superficial fascia, hypodermis, and subcutaneous area have all the same meaning. So, in this class, you will probably know a number of names for a particular structure. Right, and on a practicum, you only have to put one correct name down, right? So because you only have that one little line. But it's good to know a bunch of names for things. That's why we point that out to you, because who knows what somebody in your field, when you start your service, is going to call something. So you got to know a couple different names of structures. If you put a name down on a test and I mark it wrong and you know it's right, then just show me a reference, like maybe in your lab manual, because I wrote the lab manual, and you could say, oh, well, look, you forgot that term, because here it is in something you wrote, or your textbook, or good reputable reference online, right, but not a website that you made the night before to show me that it is existing online someplace, right? So I'll give you 100% credit for that, and then I'll learn something, which is really nice. So is it strange that something can have more than one name? No, because you all have more than one name, right? Sometimes you're Mr., sometimes you're Ms., sometimes you're Tiffany, and I have a bunch of different names as well, right? Sometimes my name is Honey, believe it or not, right? So, things can have a number of different names, and you have to know by context what they're talking about, right? Okay. All right, so remember that epidermis grows, right, from the stratum basale to the stratum corneum. It turns from cuboidal or columnar cells into squamous, and so we call it a stratified squamous epithelium due to the apical surface. The shape of those cells are thin. They're flat. All right, so I talked pretty much about all of the skin. We've got to talk about some accessory structures of skin. We've even talked about the dermis already. We talked about the kinds of connective tissue it is, the colors. Let's look at some accessory structures. Where do I have that on the list? Ah, here. Okay, I'll go back up to skin color in a little bit. Hair. Hair is an accessory structure. And so the part of the hair that's sticking up above the surface of the skin is called the hair shaft, right? And then below is the hair follicle. And there's some layers, right, within the hair follicle that I'm really not going to go over very much. But these are keratinocytes as well. And your hair is kind of tough. What's the chemical that gives hair strength? It is keratin. Yeah, it's keratin, right? And then there are melanocytes in a hair follicle that can change the color of your hair. So depending on the number and kinds of melanocytes. So all of our hair can have a little bit different color. There is a, I'm going to talk about skin color in just a little bit. All right, so what kind of epithelium is that? Epidermis, once again? Okay, the epidermis is an epithelium. And remember, we classify an epithelium by two different categories, shape and layers. So what kind of epithelium is the epidermis? Stratified squamous, right? So the epidermis grows in sheets, right? Because it's a stratified squamous epithelium. All right, well, you might wonder, well, how is the hair, since it's made out of keratinocytes, why is it really the same thing as the stratum corneum? It doesn't look the same at all. But you know what? It's made from sheets, but the sheets have been bent to make a cylinder. So instead of being flat, the cells grow as a cylinder, so it's layers and layers and layers of keratinocytes, and then the cylinders grow up out of the skin. So they really are skin cells, but of course by the time they get up over here, they're dead, and they're just filled with keratin. Skin also has this muscle, the erector pili muscle. How come it's not here it is, labeled right here. This one is activated by your autonomic nervous system. You can't control when this muscle contracts. So if you cannot control this, is this cardiac muscle, skeletal muscle, or smooth muscle? It's under involuntary control. You can't control it. Skeletal, cardiac, or smooth? Can it be cardiac? No, it can't be cardiac because where do you find cardiac? In your heart. We're not looking at the heart right here. Is it attached to a skeleton? No, can't be skeletal muscle. So by process of elimination, you know this is smooth muscle, right? Smooth muscle. Interesting place for smooth muscle. Usually we find smooth muscle deep inside our body. So when the autonomic nervous system sends a signal to smooth muscle to contract, it pulls the hair follicle. Instead of lying down, it pulls the hair follicle straight up and down, and it's going to pull it up toward the surface, and it's going to form a little dome right over here, or a pimple, and that's what we would call a goose pimple, right, or a goose bump. And when do you have goosebumps? When you're cold, or under certain kinds of emotional stimulus as well, is when this thing contracts. The erector pili causes goose pimples. All right, what else do we have? Let's look at some glands. And I see two kinds of glands. In lab, you have to know three. But this is a good start to know glands. There is a gland that is always associated with a hair follicle. And here I see it, and here I see it. I see this duct bringing material into the hair follicle. All right, so what kind of gland is this one right here, if it has a duct like I see right here? Is it exocrine or endocrine? It's got to be an exocrine gland, right, because it doesn't secrete a hormone into the blood. And this is what we call a sebaceous gland. Sebaceous gland, always associated with a hair follicle, and it secretes something that's kind of oily, so it acts as a lubricant so that when the stratum basale of this hair follicle undergoes mitosis and moves up to the surface of the skin, right, it can slip up to the surface of the skin pretty easily. That chemical compound is called sebum. That's why this is a sebaceous gland. Sebum also can help prevent infection or bacterial growth. So that's another reason. It's not really a good antibiotic, but it kind of prevents the growth of bacteria from happening, from getting inside your body. Okay, and then I see another gland. I see the gland right over here, and then here's a duct that goes to the surface of the skin. So again, what kind of gland is this one? Exocrine or endocrine? Exocrine, because it has a duct. And this is your typical kind of sweat gland that produces a watery solution and salt, sometimes variable concentrations of salt, depending for how long you've been sweating and what your hydration state is. So it secretes a watery solution to the surface of your skin, and when it vibrates, when that water evaporates, right, that cools your skin down, right, to help maintain body temperature so that you don't overheat. This is what we call an eccrine sweat gland. Right, so you got sebaceous and eccrine. In lab, you're going to see that there's a really big, huge one over here that's called an apocrine gland. Right, so I can't show you that one. But in lab, I'll show you for sure. So those are the three kinds of glands. There are a couple of different structures for sensation. We look at a Merkel's disc, which is right in the stratum basale on one of those slides. And then in lab, you're going to also see a Meissner's corpuscle up in this area. And then I see one that's really interesting here. It kind of looks like an onion. So it has a lot of different layers. And when something has a lot of layers, we call it lamellated, layers. And so this is a lamellar corpuscle. Corpuscle just means a round structure. Lamellar corpuscle, but people usually call it a Pacinian corpuscle. Pacinian and lamellar corpuscle are the same. And these are located deep in the dermis or even in the hypodermis. So in order to stimulate this thing, it can't just be a light touch. It has to be a very strong depression or strong vibration. So if somebody squeezes your hand really, really hard, these are the ones that tell you that you're being squeezed really, really strenuously, right? The Pacinian corpuscle, strong vibration. The Meissner's and Merkel's disc for light touch or pressure and vibration. I see some other nerves. Here is a nerve that is attached to the erector pili. That's a motor nerve that causes this muscle to contract. I see some other nerves, right, that I don't have any kind of special ending. So we call that a free nerve ending if it doesn't have any kind of lamellations to it. And these free nerve endings are important for three things. They can sense hot, some can sense hot, some can sense cold, and some can sense pain. Right? So when you damage your skin, some of these nerve endings will send pain signals to your brain so that you know your skin is being damaged. Right? That's really important to know, because what are you going to do when you know your skin is being damaged? When you feel pain, for instance, what will you do? Yeah, you'll stay away from it, or possibly move away from whatever that stimulus is, if possible, right? So if you pick up something that's really hot, like you're using a pan on the stove and you picked up the handle and you weren't expecting it to be hot, but it was real hot, you would feel that, and then you would drop that damaging stimulus from your body to prevent further damage. So these pain receptors are really important. And sometimes when you go to the dentist, they tell you not to do something because they deaden the sensation of pain in your lips and your tongue and even for your teeth, so that you don't feel when they're drilling around inside your mouth. Sorry about bringing that to your awareness, right? It's no fun to have your tooth drilled, but at least you don't feel it. But then that also means you don't have pain sensation in your lips and in your tongue, and why could that be really dangerous? Why does that prove that pain sensation is great to have? Yeah, if you drink something really hot, you burn your tongue or your lips and you don't even know it. Okay, so that would be one reason. Another reason is when you eat something, you can't tell if you're chewing food or chewing food and your tongue. Right? So that's terrible when that happens, right? So pain sensation is very valuable. So a lot of times when you go to the dentist and you get anesthesia in your mouth, they tell you don't eat anything until you have sensation returning once again. So free nerve endings are responsible for that. All right, so I think that pretty much describes this slide pretty well. All right, well, we're interested in layers. Now is a good time to talk some more, a little bit about layers. In lab, I showed you the layers of the Grand Canyon, and that one slide had probably 50 or 60 layers, right? So if you're a geologist, you'd really get into all those layers, because you would know what's happening on the Earth millions and millions of years ago. And in physiology, it's important because these layers have a little bit different function. Like, what's the function of the stratum basale right here? Yeah, growth, right? Because mitosis is taking place there. The function of the stratum corneum is to protect deeper layers of the skin, right, because it has a tough chemical right there. So layers are pretty important, but a lot of times people that are just starting with anatomy just kind of get bored with layers, right, and because they're just, you think it's just something to memorize, but they have specific functions. All right, so let's go over something that maybe you can relate to, but I hope not personally, but maybe you could relate to it at some level. All right, let's talk about burns. There are three kinds of burns. A first-degree burn is when the hair shaft, right, might be burned off the skin, right, and maybe one little layer of the stratum corneum, but no further damage is done to cells, right, that are deeper, like the spinosum or granulosum, certainly not the basale layer right here. So when this hair shaft gets burned off and maybe this first layer of the stratum corneum gets damaged and burned off, is that a really bad burn, or is this person kind of lucky? Lucky. Because why? Because the hair can grow back, right? Because the cells that are making hair are way down here in the dermis. And what about the epidermis? Where are the cells that allow the epidermis to grow back? What layer? Yeah, stratum basale. And in that first degree burn, they haven't been damaged, so that person's really lucky, their skin will grow back, right? That's really nice. A second degree burn. All right, so now all of these hair shafts are burned off. Maybe the whole stratum corneum is burned off. Yeah, but maybe not. But the cells that are deeper still basically are undamaged, but slightly damaged because I see some capillaries, right, in these dermal papillae. They've been damaged to a certain degree and they start to leak fluid, right? And that fluid we call plasma. And there might be chemicals released by these cells saying that they are damaged, and it causes an inflammation. And that causes these blood vessels, these capillaries, to leak even more fluid. So then you get a collection of fluid underneath the epidermis, or someplace maybe in the dermis, and that's what we call a blister, right? Because these capillaries are damaged. All right, well, is that person lucky or unlucky if they get a second degree burn? They're still kind of lucky because the stratum basale right here is still alive, right? It's just been irritated. There's inflammation, but the stratum basale is still alive. So what does that mean for the epidermis? Can it grow back or not? Yes, it can. So I consider that person pretty lucky. Let's consider a third degree burn. Somebody with a third degree burn, hair shafts are burned off. The whole epithelium is burned off, and let's say down into the papillary layer of the dermis, right? So that person no longer has an epidermis. What are they susceptible to? Dehydration and infection, right? Because they no longer have those Langerhans cells. They no longer have any of that glycolipid that works like a saran wrap on our body to prevent dehydration. Now, is that person lucky or unlucky if they have a burn down to the level where I have the cursor right now? Lucky or unlucky?
Unlucky?
Unlucky. Okay, I need to change your point of view a little bit. All right, I still think they're kind of lucky or fortunate. And that's because I want to look at the layers once again. All right, so what is the living layer of the epidermis?
Stratum basale.
Stratum basale, right? And can you see, where do I have my cursor kind of tracing right now? What layer?
Papillary.
Okay. So here's the papillary layer of the dermis, but I'm pointing to things in the epidermis. And so I would like to know what this layer is. Okay, lucidum is going to be up over here. Okay, it's the deepest layer of the epidermis. The stratum basale. Yeah, I'm trying to point to the stratum basale. It's not a really big picture, but what happens if I zoom in? Can I zoom in? Whoa, oh. I should have done that earlier. Look, I still have my pointer. Usually I don't like to zoom in because I lose a pointer. Okay, let me move it over here. Nice. Okay, so what layer is this right here? Stratum basale, right? And then what do you got? Spinosum, granulosum, okay, on and on and on. Well, and what's the function of the stratum basale? Growth, because mitosis is taking place. Let's trace. All right, this layer. All right, so all of these in a third degree burn, these cells are gone, but let's keep tracing. Where does it go? It goes around the sebaceous gland, goes back to the hair follicle, and then where does the stratum basale go? All the way down deep into the dermis. Can you follow that? That what I traced right here? And we said the skin was damaged to this layer right here, but not down here, so what does that mean for this patient? Their skin can grow back because there are still some stratum basale cells lining these hair follicles. So sometimes we consider, right, the root of a hair follicle as a reservoir of epidermal cells that can grow back, as long as we protect the patient from infection and dehydration. So I think that patient is still pretty lucky because their skin will grow back. Now, what about somebody that gets a burn to the level where, again, the epidermis goes, the papillary layer of the dermis goes, and even the reticular layer of the dermis is damaged? Is that a fortunate person? No, because can their skin ever grow back? No, because this whole stratum basale everywhere in the skin has been burned away. All right, and then what would that person need if they're going to have a chance of staying alive? Yeah, they would need a graft, maybe from some other part of their body. All right, so it's really important to know these layers, what their function is, like the stratum basale, where you find them, and of course that's going to make a really big difference on how you diagnose disease and how then you would treat somebody by knowing layers. And the skin is just one example of why layers are important. But layers are important all over the body. Okay. Oh, in your notes, look at this. I have sebaceous glands and sweat glands. And, oh, here, okay, I didn't have apocrine. And here's apocrine. You will have to see that in lab. Apocrine gland is a sweat gland, a little bit different than eccrine. And it's located in the axilla, around genitalia, external ear, and it doesn't secrete water and salt. It secretes more of an organic secretion. I don't think we really know exactly why. Maybe it's a little antibacterial action. No, I'm not sure why. I know why the ceruminous gland secretes something. We'll talk about that in a second. But anyway, this organic secretion is not odoriferous by itself, but since it is an organic compound, other things can use it as an energy source, like bacteria, and different bacteria produce different kinds of odors. Right, so that's the axillary region is a little bit more odoriferous than other parts of your body because it has what kind of gland? An apocrine gland. Okay, another kind, ceruminous gland. It's a kind of sweat gland, and it secretes cerumen into the external auditory canal. Okay, and that's within the external auditory meatus of the temporal bone. And you have something that vibrates back and forth at the back of that little tunnel, and it's called a tympanic membrane, and you all know it to be the eardrum, right? So it beats back and forth when sound hits it, and it has to be pliable. It has to be able to move back and forth. If it was really all dried out and rigid, when sound hits it, it would break, right? So this ceruminous gland just protects that tympanic membrane from drying out and keeps it really nice and pliable so that it can vibrate. And mammary glands are modified sweat glands at all, right? And they produce nourishment for infants. And I forgot how many mammary glands we have. I think we all have 8, but we can only see 2 typically. Even males have 8. You got to look really, really close to see the other auxiliary mammary glands. Okay. All right. Another accessory structure, nails. Let me find something about nails. Nice one. Okay, so here's a nail. This finger right here is what we call a digit, right? So I got 5 digits on this hand, I got 5 digits on the other. There are bones inside of a digit to give it its structure and its strength, and I see a bone right here. So here's a bone. The bones in a digit are called a phalanx, and you have 3 bones in most of your digits, like your index finger, there's 3 bones, and you can see 2 joints in it, so you know there's 3 bones in there. Those are all phalanges. So phalanx is a bone inside of your fingertip, and it looks like I see a certain kind of connective tissue right here. It's certainly not muscle. What kind of connective tissue does this look like? Look at that. I'm zooming in. Adipose. I like adipose. All right, so that's adipose connective tissue. Right? You don't have any muscles in your fingertip right there. But you do have dermis and epidermis. And remember, the epidermis, I can see that right here. The epidermis is the growing layer, and then we have this hard nail. The hard nail is made out of keratinocytes, and what is that compound that gives a nail a lot of strength that's inside those keratinocytes? It is keratin, right? So nails have even more keratin than your skin or even your hair. That's what makes nails really, really tough. Here is the nail matrix. That's the deepest part of the nail. This is the place where the nail grows from. All right, so these cells undergo mitosis and push the nail out. And instead of cylinders like in hair, it makes nice flat sheets of keratinocytes. All right, so that's why a nail is kind of flat, but it's just like your skin. Skin cells make it up. The part underneath this proximal nail fold, here's a fold of the nail, underneath that fold is called the root of a nail. And these cells are all dead in the root of a nail. The cells in the matrix are alive, undergoing mitosis. So where does this nail grow from? Is it the root or the matrix? Yeah, it's kind of a confusing issue to think about. But a nail grows from the matrix, not the root. So don't think of a plant, because a plant might grow from the root, but not a nail. A nail grows from the matrix. These are where the living cells are. Okay. We see a little epinicium. This is what we call a cuticle. This little flap of skin off of the proximal nail fold. And then this part of the nail that is coming out from underneath the nail fold, that's what we call the body of the nail. And then here's the free edge. So if you damage this part of your nail, okay, well, it's going to hurt really bad, but will your nail grow back? Maybe these blood vessels are going to bleed. You might get a black toenail or fingernail right here, but is that nail going to grow back? And absolutely, because here is the nail matrix way over here. If you want to prevent further growth of a nail in your body, then you have to get rid of the nail matrix, and that's a procedure some people elect for because they get such a bad fungal infection underneath the body of a nail that their one option is to have the nail removed completely, right? And then the nail matrix has to be damaged so that it doesn't grow back. Okay, that's pretty gross. Anybody ever elect to have their nails removed from their body permanently in here? Nobody's going to say, but everybody's shaking their head no. That's good. Okay. Because we're all walking around on the same floor. And, right, it's an infectious kind of disease. All right, so nails are made out of thin plates, and they're stratum corneum cells. They're filled with hard keratin. Okay. All right, so this right here is an exam figure as well. And some functions. I was going to go over some things about skin color, which is kind of fun. Skin color. Ah, skin color right here. Okay, so there are two things that can give skin color. One is pigments. We talked about that. A pigment is a chemical that can absorb a certain color of light. And remember, light from the sun contains all colors. A pigment will absorb a couple of them, at least a couple, right? At least one color. What gets reflected back to your eye is the color that you see, and also blood. So what color is blood going to give your skin? What color is blood? It's going to give it that same color. Blood is red looking, right? And so you'll be able to see that color, and it's going to be diluted out. So what's a diluted red color called? Pink, right? At least that's what I'm told, right? I have no idea what I'm talking about, but that's okay. All right, so if somebody doesn't have a lot of pigment in their skin, then they're going to look more pink because there's blood there. When you're really, really cold and blood is not going to the skin, your skin is not going to look pink. It's going to look blue. Okay? It's going to look blue. Or maybe if there's no blood at all, it might look a little whitish. All right, so these are the two reasons why skin color changes. And even over your lifetime or even in different parts of your body. So let's look at that. The natural sunscreen that makes your skin really dark, called melanin. Where does melanin come from? Melanocytes in the stratum basale, and that really protects your skin. It's a brown to black pigment. And guess what the most damaging thing you can do to your skin is? Sunlight. That's right. Go out in sunlight. Very damaging, right? It won't hurt you in one day. But if it's cumulative over a number of days or maybe a couple of years when you're growing up, it is very dangerous, right? It ages skin prematurely. But people that have more melanin are more protected from sunlight, and so their skin has a tendency to remain younger for a longer period of time in their life. All right, that's due to melanin from melanocytes. All right, melanocytes produce melanocyte in the stratum basale. Oh, that's just what I said. Okay, what about moles or age spots? Well, that's due to an increased number of melanocytes in one just small localized area, right? If you look at your skin, it's not uniform color all the way across, but you might have some spots because of an increased number of melanocytes in a particular area. Freckles. We can see freckles in people that have relatively light-colored skin. It's just an area that's increase of melanin production in a really small, small area. And that kind of melanin is not a really dark kind of melanin, right? Somebody has freckles. Albinism is interesting to talk about. Albinism is a condition where a person doesn't have melanocytes, or probably more importantly, they have melanocytes, but they can't produce the chemical melanin That's a pigment. They produce a chemical that's not a pigment. All right, so then their skin looks very, very white or very, very... What happens if you don't have melanocytes? What color? You see blood. So they're going to look really pink as a result of that. Okay, and we don't call them albinos, right? That's really bad. We call that a person with albinism, right? That's how we always talk about somebody. Okay. As a matter of fact, it's even not classy to talk about somebody in the following way: a diabetic, right? That's not a proper way of talking about them. It is what? A person with diabetes. Right. Because we don't want to stigmatize anybody. All right, so a person with albinism that has the inability to produce melanin, and they're born with that condition. That's what we mean by congenital. Means it doesn't happen over your lifetime. You either have it or you're not when you're born. And it is also inherited based on genes that you get from your parents. And we don't see many people with albinism in Southern California because why? They have no melanin, they're not protected from sunlight, and we have very strong sun here in Southern California. So if you were a person with albinism, where might you like to live in the United States? Someplace really high, not altitude, but from the equator. And so Seattle would be a good guess for me, right? Might have a population of people with albinism. And of course, if you go to Alaska, in Alaska the sun doesn't even come out sometimes in the wintertime. So, but it's really cold, and I don't think people really would like to live there anyway. Okay, so albinism, right, produces a condition where somebody kind of looks white or pink, completely unprotected from sunlight. They can burn in probably a minute if they go out in the sun, really, really fast. Cyanosis, what color is that? Does anybody know what color cyanosis is? Blue color, right. So when you're really, really cold, the blood that's going to your skin is just venous blood. It's coming back from your skin. You don't have arterial blood, which is red. And so when blood doesn't have oxygen in it, it turns from red to a blue color. So anytime we have unoxygenated blood going to the skin, then somebody's going to look blue. And we call that cyanosis. And that condition can be produced by some things other than temperature, and that's a really important color to look for a newborn infant, which we call a neonate, right? If somebody is born cyanotic or blue color, then we know there's something wrong with their lungs or there's something wrong with their heart. They're not getting oxygenated blood in their body, and that's a really serious condition, right? That's like being choked to death. So then you got to find out right away what area of the body might you want to look at with imaging techniques right away when somebody's born cyanotic, blue-looking. What body cavity has your heart? Okay, pericardium. Ah, very good. Okay, pericardium. And you might want to look at some great blood vessels around the pericardium. So you might want to look at that whole center area, not just the pericardial cavity, but what is that big, a little bit bigger cavity that the heart is in and some blood vessels above it. Not on the sides, but just right smack in the center. Mediastinum. Yeah, that's a good one to know for the test. Okay. So, yeah, some mediastinal scans will be ordered right away. Okay, jaundice. What color is jaundice? Yellow. That's another color when somebody's born they look for right away. And what does that mean? Well, jaundice comes from a chemical that is produced in red blood cells. Jaundice is a breakdown product of hemoglobin. Hemoglobin is real important because it delivers oxygen everywhere in your body. And sometimes when a baby is in utero, a mother's antibodies can cross the placenta, and then the mother's own immune system attacks the blood cells of their baby before they're born. And that's why years ago when people got married, they had to have a blood test to see if it was possible for this condition to develop. And when a mom's immune system kills red blood cells, then the baby's born anemic because their red blood cells are destroyed, and there's so much hemoglobin released into the infant that it can't be processed and getting rid of, and that leftover hemoglobin has a yellow color. It's called bilirubin, and it's really hard, well, it's impossible for a fetus to get rid of it, or even difficult for a neonate. Bilirubin is toxic to the development of nervous systems. So for a newborn baby, it's really important to get rid of that bilirubin from their body, because it will prevent development of their brain and other parts of their nervous system. Somebody that's older could be jaundiced, and that could be due to, again, abnormal breakdown of red blood cells, or it could be, and bilirubin is processed by the liver, so if the liver isn't doing its job, somebody might develop a jaundice condition, and so another reason could be liver damage. And so liver cirrhosis, probably not fatty liver. So what are the progression of disease in the liver? Well, first it comes fatty, then it becomes cirrhosis, and then it becomes liver cancer, right? So liver cirrhosis is kind of right in between something really good and bad. So when somebody has liver cirrhosis, liver cancer, they can become jaundiced because the liver isn't doing their job. Or if a person has cancer and they're under chemotherapy, the chemotherapy might affect the liver and reduce its function. So even somebody on chemotherapy might have jaundice as well. Okay, and as soon as they're off that chemotherapy, hopefully their liver comes back, and then that jaundice was just a temporary condition. All right, so what do we got? No color, blue, yellow. Birthmarks due in the dermis due to an increased growth of blood vessels in the dermis. Right, and so probably it will have more of a reddish kind of color if it's a birthmark. All right. Well, okay, as we get older, okay, a lot of us will notice that our hair will start to turn gray or white or silver. So what kind of cell is not working in that hair follicle anymore? A melanocyte, right? Okay. Maybe, let me go back to that initial picture right here. All right, so as we get older, these blood vessels in the hair follicle no longer bring enough oxygen and nutrients to these cells so that the melanocytes stop producing melanin, and then as this hair grows out, it's going to look white. So as we grow older, how come our hair turns white but our skin doesn't turn white? Anybody ever think of that? Does anybody know? Do you have grandparents where their hair turned white and their skin? I don't think so. Okay. Well, I don't know. So I thought about that because I thought that was interesting. And it's because this plexus of blood vessels in the hair follicle, as we grow older, right, start to die, right, or lose their ability to deliver oxygen, right, to a greater degree than the blood vessels that are in this normal dermal papillae. So these melanocytes in the stratum basale in skin right here still can function until way, way, way later in life, right, or even through a person's whole lifetime. But this area of a hair follicle, the blood supply starts to degrade and go away, and their hair turns white. Oh, what else happens as we grow older because these blood vessels in a hair follicle degenerate? Yeah, you don't have as much hair, right? Your hair falls out, and your hair becomes thin as a result of that. And so what does it do to? Blood supply to different parts of your skin. Okay. Some people can turn white. Does anybody know what that condition is? Usually it's not over your whole body, but some localized area. It's called, I think Michael Jackson said he had that. Vitiligo. And it's just some area in your body where melanocytes stop working, and then that area is completely unprotected from sunlight. Person can get sunburned very, very easily, and we think it's an autoimmune disease where a person's own immune system attacks melanocytes specifically in the stratum basale in that one area, and that's why they have a little patch of white right there. Okay, the sign-in sheet is going around, so make sure you sign the sign-in sheet. Who's got the sign-in sheet? Anybody have it? Yeah, here it is, right back there. It's coming down. Let me turn the lights on before you go. Yeah. Today?
Yeah.